Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming today. Today we're going to get to meet and we're going to learn all about Dick Armstrong, who was the original public relations director of the Baltimore Orioles. And also we're going to find out about the original Mr. Oriole, who just happens to be, whether you love mascots or not, he's the first mascot that we know of, the performing type with the costume and the human being inside, whoever cavorted on a major league field. Now, most of you probably have never heard of Dick Armstrong, but he was from Baltimore. He really lived an amazing life. He was a baseball man, a man of the press box for about his first 35 years. Then he became a man of God for the next 60-some-odd years, Presbyterian minister, missionary, educator. That was his life. A founding member of the Association for Christian Athletes. So he was also a prolific writer, a poet, a musical composer. And lucky for me, he became a good friend of mine back during our joint years together at the Princeton Theological Seminary, where I got to know him very well. He was born in Baltimore in 1924. He was Herb Armstrong's son. Herb Armstrong, the award that the Oriole advocates give out for the non-playing members of the Orioles Hall of Fame, it's named after Herb Armstrong. So you'll hear me refer to Herb later on. He was a three-sport athlete at McDonough. He was very good academically, and that earned him a scholarship to Princeton University in 1942. Now, like most young men at the time, he had a detour with World War II. And he went and he studied for his the Navy V-12 program for a commission as an ensign. And he was deployed to the USS Chandelure there in 1945 and was an officer of the Navy until he was discharged in 1946. He returned to Princeton for 1947, where he earned his undergrad degree in economics. And he was a pitcher and an outfielder on the Princeton baseball team in 1947. When he graduated, he still had the itch to play baseball. So he approached the Philadelphia A's about a tryout. And lo and behold, they signed him to a minor league contract. And they assigned him to the Martinsville, Virginia, Carolina League Club. And then he went on to the Lancaster Red Roses of the Interstate League for the remainder of the season. And there's a picture of the ballpark in Lancaster, which I believe is still standing, Stump Field. That was the home of the Red Roses. A fellow by the name of Art Ehlers was the farm director of the A's organization back then. Now remember that name. You're going to hear it a few times in his presentation. He suggested that Dick join the A's minor league business operation. So he sent Dick to a baseball business managers conference in the autumn of 1947, and that was the beginning for him. Lo and behold, in 1948, he found himself in Portsmouth, Ohio, working for a brand new Class D team, the Portsmouth A's. He was the business manager of our team, and that's Dick Armstrong there in the suit on the extreme right. It was his job to sell minor league baseball to the Portsmouth area, and he did everything. Financial accounts, marketing and promotional strategies, special nightly promotions. In fact, in an article about Dick that was in the Sporting News about 4 or 5 years later, J.G. Taylor Spink was quoted as saying, Armstrong had to do everything that year except sell peanuts. So that's what life was like in the minor leagues. They led the league in attendance that year. Dick was always very proud of that. And there you can see the crowded parking lot in Portsmouth, Ohio in 1948. The following year, Dick organized a Connie Mack Day at the ballpark, and obviously he made a very big impression on the grand old man of baseball. So much so that Art Ehlers, there he is again, encouraged Dick to apply for the newly formed position of public relations director for the A's in 1950. Now, PR wasn't what it is today. It was still evolving in major league organizations back then, and Dick's proposal was the only one received that mentioned the 50th anniversary of Connie Mack being with the A's. Based on that, the 28-year-old Armstrong got the job. He established an elaborate all-season Golden Jubilee celebration for Connie Mack. He designed this wonderful magazine for her during that year. You can see a copy up in the Hall of Fame if you ever look through Dick's collection. The A's or Connie Mack and Connie Mack did not cooperate that year, though, for the big party. The A's were 52-102 that year. And then toward the end of the year, Connie Mack's health started failing him. After the 1950 season, Mack finally retired from the A's. Dick stayed with the A's through 1952. And then in 1953, he took a job with an advertising and promotion agency in Philadelphia. He wanted to branch out into the field a little more. In the spring of that year, the Boston Braves got a hold of his agency, the OR agency, saying that they needed something quick. They needed a ticket brochure that could be mailed to the population in Milwaukee, because they planned on moving to Milwaukee immediately after spring training. So they got Dick together with an art director there at the agency, and they designed this two-color mailer that went out to everybody in Milwaukee, helping the Braves get started there. You see all the National League stars on the left, and you see all the Boston Braves on the right. Well, lo and behold, 1953, here's the story about the St. Louis Browns. Bill Veeck sold the right to the American League franchise to a Baltimore group led by Clarence W. Miles, who was an attorney here. Now, at that time, the AAA Orioles were a very successful franchise, led by Jack Dunn III and also by Herb Armstrong. Herb was very prominent in their front office back then. Baltimore was awarded the franchise for the 1954 season to become the Orioles, and lo and behold, Art Ehlers became the Orioles' first general manager. And he immediately knew who he wanted for the first public relations director of the Baltimore Orioles, Dick Armstrong. Well, Dick went right to work. He was eager for the opportunity to establish the major league club in his hometown, setting up press relations, marketing promotions. He also organized the big opening day parade that took place for the Orioles' home opener that year. It was attended by thousands of people downtown, including Vice President Richard Nixon. And more than 46,000 fans came to Memorial Stadium that day to witness the O's do something rare that season. They defeated the Chicago White Sox 3-1. All right, where are we here? Okay, so let's meet Mr. Oriole now so we can blend these two stories together. In late 1953, Dick realized that he needed a cartoon caricature Oriole to go on letterhead and marketing materials and all that. So he created a contest where he encouraged local artists to send to him their impressions on what this jaunty but likable bird, as he used to call him, should look like. And the winning entry was produced by Jim Hartzell of the Baltimore Sun. And there on the right, you see the article that was in the Sun in January of 54, introducing Mr. Oriole as the first little logo for the Baltimore Orioles. And here you see him making his proud ascension to the throne on the cover of the 1954 Baltimore Orioles sketchbook, otherwise known as the yearbook. So all of a sudden, Mr. Oriole was appearing everywhere. He was on kids' baseball jackets. He was encouraging the kids to watch Bobo Newsom's Knothole Gang. He was on Oriole ashtrays, on Oriole ties. I got the Oriole bird on mine. And he was even encouraging people to buy RCA Victor desktop radios for 1995 to listen to the game. And lo and behold, even today, I went into the exhibit section, and he was on a T-shirt that I found to buy for $10. And boy, am I happy I got this today. So anyway, this is going home. I can't even fit into this thing anymore, but I'm going to put it in a frame or something. But anyway, all right. So Mr. Oriole was becoming the signature of the new Orioles. In fact, the bird was becoming so well known that for that parade that I was describing, somebody made this big statue, this big, you know, papier-mâché statue of him to put on a float. And that gave Dick an idea. He had a friend classmate of his in Baltimore named Johnny Myers. Johnny was a very creative guy. He was an accomplished trumpet player, whatnot. They got their heads together and they said, wouldn't it be cool if we can design a costume that we can put a human in and have him run around the field and the stands at Memorial Stadium and entertain the fans? And that's exactly what they did. Now, bear with me with the technology. This is where I would like you to meet Dick Armstrong. Instead of me telling you how the introduction of Mr. Oriole and the creation went, I'm going to let him tell you. This was an interview that I did with him back in 2016 at the Princeton Theological Seminary, an oral history interview. And, of course, I mean, 12 hours of interview, most of it was on religion, but he had to get all the baseball stuff in there, too. So so let me see if I can get this the right way. You don't want to see the whole clip, but this... All right, Dick, hold on. Okay. Let me just get it to the right point here, and I should have my glasses on while I'm doing this. Okay, I think I'm right. I think I'm good here. Okay. No, I'm not. Okay.
You would understand that being a baseball person, but so I put Mr. Oriole mascot, and I got something I knew nothing about.
He's talking about his conversation with the Orioles here about it.
Did you know there was a virtual mascot? Hall of Fame. Okay. Well, I had a hard time finding out who started and everything, but it turned out to be a guy named Dave Raymond, who was the first Phillies fanatic. Okay. I got him on the phone. It was this strange, interesting conversation, which I'd love to tell you about, but the long and short of this, when I went on their website, and it was a virtual Hall of Fame, they're building a building. They have a 501c3, and they're going to be this big building. It's too much detail, but it's important for this story. I said, use the first...
We're going to move ahead a little bit to where he talks about the actual creation of Mr. Oriole. I don't want to run over time here.
Final thing.
Here it is.
When we introduced this, I had a guy who was a costume designer, Macon. His name was Tinker, related to Tinker to Everson Chance. Beautiful costume. Close to 7 feet, maybe 6 feet and a half tall, depending on the size of the guy in it. I had a high school teammate and friend. The name was Johnny Myers. Be the first Mr. Oriole, because I said, jokingly, partly, he had the legs for the part. So he gets in this thing. And when he made his debut in Memorial Stadium, which is packed, it was a sensational thing. People went wild. They'd never seen anything like this. That's on the bird leading, dancing on the clubhouse, the dugout. But what they didn't know was that Johnny was a professional trumpet player and a fantastic one. And the way the wings were made, he had straps there. He couldn't see his hands, but he could hold the trumpet. So he brings up, he couldn't see his hands, just feathers, and he starts playing this jazz. We had the only trumpet playing bird in captivity. You can't imagine the effect of that. All of that has been forgotten somehow. Where is Mr. Oriole?
Well, possibly not forgotten, but talking with Bill this morning, there's no whereabouts of this uniform anymore, and it just kind of got lost over time, I would imagine. But there is evidence that Mr. Oriole existed, and I'm going to show you it. And now I have my glasses on, so while I'm struggling with the technology, at least I'll be able to see what I'm struggling with. Okay? So now we're going to have to probably suffer through an ad that I will kill. Okay? Once it starts. It started up for me when I was in here before the presentation, so. La 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 la. Yeah, okay, come on, baby.
How old was he in 2016?
He was already in his 90s. Yeah, okay, so let me get this to where it should be. Okay, so again, bear with. This is. Okay, hold on. This is not it. Okay, whoops. Okay, I got a problem. This thing advanced to another thing that we don't want to see here. Let me just make sure. Okay, here we go. Here we go. I'm getting it. There we go. Okay, here we go. This is actually from an Orioles. Back in 1992, the Orioles did a video on their years at Memorial Stadium. And then this was from the first segment, say, in the early years. So you're going to see a little bit here about opening day. You're going to see Nixon throwing out the first ball. And then you're going to see 3 seconds of Mr. Oriole, but it's diabolical just seeing him. Okay, we're going to start Richard Nixon.
First official pitch was thrown by the young right-hander Mayne Turley. Catcher Clint Scrapiron Courtney homered from the left side of the plate, and third baseman Vern Stevens belted one from the right. The 3-1 bird victory capped a great day for the team and for the city. That first year, the Birds were still very much the Browns, dressed in feathers.
Dressed in feathers. Okay, Mr. Met was not the first mascot. Ted Gianulis and San Diego Chicken were not the first mascots. Philly Fanatic was not. Mr. Orioles was. And I really wish that the Orioles and Dick could get recognition for this. But, like, the Hall of Fame turns a deaf ear to me when I try to get them to include a picture of this in their galleries. I mean, I don't know why, but suffice to be said. Okay, so, okay, come on, that's enough. All right. I know. All right.
Major League Baseball. On September the 14th of that year.
There we go. So anyway, I had a still shot already, just in case it didn't come up, like it almost didn't. So, all right, but you know, so we have a couple of photos also. This is where Dr. Tom meets Mr. Oriole. Dr. Tom was a chimpanzee that was from the Baltimore Zoo in 1954. And Dick always told me that the most important thing that the chimpanzee was worried about that day was grabbing feathers out of the costume, right? And then finally, here's the actress Sherry Britton being escorted by Mr. Oriole down past some very appreciative Oriole players in the Oriole dugout. So, yes, Mr. Oriole did exist. So just to wrap up, you know, Dick's creativity was not limited to mascots. He commissioned the very first scientific method survey of fans coming into Memorial Stadium for games in 1954, and the results of which said so much about the fan base coming in that it got a full-page spread in the sporting news in January 1955. And there you see Dick's picture there. And he was getting to be really well known. In fact, there was a lot of thought that he was going to go very far in baseball front offices. He wanted to be a general manager, according to what he had told me later on. But something else happened. This is City Island Ballpark in Daytona Beach. In 1955, the Orioles had their spring training there. Now, it's now known as Jackie Robinson Stadium. It was there that Dick had a life-changing event. He was driving home one night from dinner with his wife, Margie, driving back to the hotel. Suddenly, he started gripping the steering wheel hard, and he pulled the car over, and Margie said, "Dick, are you okay?" She thought he was having a heart attack. And Dick said, "Yes, Margie, I'm okay, but I got to tell you this. I feel the presence of God in this car, and he's calling me to be a minister." Okay? Long story short, Dick left the Orioles at the end of 1955. He enrolled in Princeton Theological Seminary that you see there on the left. That's the chapel. On the right is a picture of Dick, right around 2011, with two of his favorite things in life, a baseball bat and a Bible. All right? Later on, he attended a ceremony for Connie Mack's 150th birthday there on the left. That's Connie Mack III, the senator. In the center, Connie Mack's grandson, along with Dick and Dick's son, Woody. And then finally here, in I think it was 2012, I'm sorry, 2014, Dick threw out the first ball at Camden Yards during a celebration there. And very ironically, the umpire was the Oriole Bird, who many say was the first article, the first mascot for the Orioles, but we know different, don't we? All right. Well, hey, listen, thank you very much for coming. I do appreciate it. If anybody has any questions, Thank you. We'll get the microphone here in case you want to ask something.
So I interviewed him probably 25 years ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was at the Trenton Times, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
He was a phenomenal storyteller.
Oh, yes.
I mean, just everything. And I just wanted to supplement what you told with one other anecdote, was when he was with the Philadelphia Athletics, one of his big promotional things was a photo of Connie Mack in a baseball uniform,
yes,
at like age 90.
Yes.
After Connie Mack had managed in suit and tie for like, mm-hmm, 50 years.
Yes.
And he has this photo.
And he had it with the catcher's mitt.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. And
yeah.
I think it's, you can find it.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere online, but it's really worth it. And that was one of his big PR stunts.
Let me also tell you that there is, he wrote a book in 2011 that chronicles this entire period of his life. And I don't have it on the slide, but it's called A Sense of Being Called. It's by Dick Armstrong. Go on Amazon, you know, Google it, you'll find it. And it's really a fascinating story about all this happened to him, including losing a son for leukemia while this was all happening. So another good Philadelphia A's story was, to try to get people into the stands, he had to get creative. He actually held a weigh-in one night for Bobby Shantz, the pitcher. Because there was always a controversy about how much Bobby Shantz weighed. And he invited in the Philadelphia Department of Weights and Measures. And they put up a big scale there at home plate, and they did the measurement. I forget what it came to, but it was a lot less than anybody ever thought. Bobby Shantz, who was the MVP that year, whatever. Any other questions?
Is your 12 hours accessible anywhere?
No. It is not. But I have all the files, but Princeton Seminary has not yet posted everything. Yes?
It's noteworthy that he received his conversion on Damascus Road. Because that is the road that he saw in St. Paul.
But that's why he calls it his Damascus Road experience. Because of the passage. By the way, I also don't have this on a slide, but you guys here don't need it. I did a rather lengthy biographical piece on Dick for the Sabre Biography Project. So if you want, go onto that, go into the biography tab, just put in Dick Armstrong in the search box, and you'll see the biography come up. It's a lot more detailed than what I did. Okay, it gives you a lot of background on everything he did, a lot of baseball stories and all that. So it's good. Yes.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to meet you outside.
Yeah.
Great presentation. You mentioned Art Ellis.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew this or not, but as a scout, he signed a young third baseman named Brooks Robinson.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. We don't even want to hear about Brooks Robinson.
Oh, wow.
Hold on, guys.
I was wondering during your interview with him, if he expressed any regret, you know, for leaving the promotions to go to Surf Lord.
Not at all.
Like that. Like, did he take his ability to promote such to the church?
Yes, he did. In fact, he was the head of development for Princeton Seminary since he started working in the development office when he was a student. So in between all of his pastoral responsibilities, he raised lots of money through promotions for the seminary. And he was with the seminary until he died. By the way, he died a week before his 95th birthday in March of 2019. And the last time I spoke on a raised platform like this was when I did one of the eulogies at his memorial service at Miller Chapel in Princeton. So this is kind of fitting. Dick, I'm doing this for you. Yes.
Is that the video that you showed, is that on YouTube?
Yes, it is a YouTube video. It's Memories, I think it's called Memories on 33rd Street. It might be called Miracles, but I think it's Memories on 33rd Street. Segment one is the early years of the Orioles from 1954, and I think it goes to either 58 or 59, and it talks about the creation and everything. I mean, it's a cool video to watch if you have the time to watch the whole thing.
That's on YouTube?
Yes, it's on YouTube, so just do a search on it. Memories on 33rd Street, it should pop right up.
54 to 58.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have time for one more question.
One more. Yeah.
Yep. Did Dick at all talk to you about the members of the CFT? Again, he was one of the first people hired. Did he ever give a sense of the group of people that he worked with in the earliest days of the Orioles to you when you would speak at all?
He did. He mentioned a lot of people like, who was the fellow who came in? Was it Paul Richards? He talked a lot about Paul Richards. He talked a lot about, he was very good friends with Ernie Harwell, who was doing the radio at that time. Beside his own dad who was there, Art Ehlers was there. The first manager, I think, was Jimmy Dykes.
Yes, he was.
Jimmy Dykes, and he talked a lot about Jimmy Dykes. Not too much about the rest of the front office folks, but in his book, there's a lot about those years in there. Okay, I think I'm done. I think they're going to kick me out of here. So I will take my water and I will take my T-shirt.